Hello and welcome to The Libertarian, a production of Defining Ideas for the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, Professor of Law at the NYU School of Law, and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the Voting Rights Act and the Supreme Court, defining civil rights for the 21st century. Richard, let's start with the basics. The U.S. Supreme Court just heard a case out of Alabama challenging Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So set the table for us. What is the Voting Rights Act, specifically Section 5, and why is it at issue now, nearly 50 years after its passage?
Precisely because it's 50 years since it's passed. The Voting Rights Act of 1965 is the second of the major civil rights acts that took place in the mid-60s, the first one being the Civil Rights Act proper, Title I of which was actually addressed to voting. And this statute, which was passed in 1965, essentially tried to take direct aim at what was regarded, and rightly so, as pervasive and abusive practices that had taken place in the South with respect to the way in which the voting system had gone. And the key thing to understand about it is that there was no particular subtlety, moral or otherwise, in the identification of what counted as an abuse. What people did, in effect, is they refused to register people on account of their race, or if they were registered, they would refuse to let them to vote, or if they let them to vote, they would find a way so as to not to count that particular vote. They would engage in all sorts of strategies to frighten and intimidate them away from the polls, and it was essentially a national disgrace. Question is what you do about it. And they made, I think, a perfectly respectable kind of judgment, which says that the basic norm under the particular statute is that you cannot either articulate or apply any particular norm which is intended to create this kind of discrimination. And so Section 2, the fundamental section, says no voting qualification or prerequisite to voting or standard practice or procedure to covering the landscape shall be imposed or applied, so articulated or applied, by any state or political subdivision, you know, the counties and the cities, in a manner which results in a denial or abridgment of a right of any citizen to vote on account of race or color. So, you know, they're trying to get just about everything in under this thing, but it's quite clearly that it's key to race or color, because that was the abuse. Nobody worried about women being excluded from the polls at that time on account of sex. So what do you do? They then introduce in Section 5 what is called the preclearance method. And this is key to the participation in elections as of 1964. And if you're below either registration or voting in certain areas for the president, you then be put under this very rigorous pre-clearance provision. And Alaska gets in because it probably had a low presidential turnout. And then you get seven or eight southern states which have exactly the same kind of problem. And they are now in a situation where any change that they want to make in any voting rule of any sort kind of description has to be approved either by a federal district court or by the attorney general. And in practice, it's always the latter. Now, at the beginning, this was a five-year statute, and a lot went wrong. And so what you did, in effect, is you really had very strong stuff. 1970 comes along, they extend it for another 5 years. You know, at this point, this diminishing marginal utility from this preclearance remedy, because most of the truly outrageous stuff has been eliminated. But, you know, there's still a fair bit going on. Then you get a seven-year extension in 1975. Now, what's happened is the more difficult the situation is to prove the abuse, you're starting to get longer periods to deal with it. And just to sort of finish up setting the table, we still have this 1964 baseline as to what counts as abuse. And in 1982, we extend it for 25 years. And then in 2006, anticipating the next year's expiration, you have this huge congressional debate. You have another 25 years going on, still tied to the 1964 baseline. So you have this very extensive set of preclearance remedies, basically a stranglehold, which is placed upon states based upon the kinds of conduct in which they engaged in at this particular point, close to 50 years before the current disputes. And some people could say enough is enough.
Now, it'd be understandable if someone listening to this podcast got confused by how Section 5 could potentially be constitutional in 1965 and potentially not in 2013. So tell us why the 15th Amendment has a bearing on that question.
Well, what happens is the 15th Amendment essentially is designed, and rightly so, to deal with those particular cases in which people are denied the right to vote on account of their race and so forth. And the second section of it says that Congress shall have the power to enforce this particular provision by appropriate kinds of remedies. So what happens is when you're looking at this case, the first thing to understand is they did not trust the courts primarily to do this. What they did, in effect, is they realized through Reconstruction, which was taking place at the time, remember, this is 1970, they expected the Congress to sort of come back down hard on that stuff. And their basic intuition, which I think was correct, was that, you know, occasional judicial actions will have to be reactive to individual lawsuits. You need proactive legislation to deal with this, and only Congress could supply it. So the issue is it still appropriate to have legislation today, which essentially is trying to remedy problems which have been largely been remedied by going back to a 1964-1965 period? And the politics is very clear. If you try to move this thing forward, virtually every one of the really bad southern states as of 1964 are out, and you have no idea how to get them back in unless you bring in everybody else. And the precondition for running this thing through Congress is that you cannot take a state like Michigan or New York and say, you know, we have this neutral criterion that we've updated in order to make sure we keep Mississippi and Alabama in on this stuff. And by the way, congratulations, you're now in as well. So the compromise took the path of least resistance. It left everybody out from preclearance who wasn't in there. And it kept it on the previous states. And they did so by not changing the date. And so the question is it appropriate to do this when, in fact, what you're having is the following situation. The means that you're using are ever more draconian. I could explain that in a bit. And the ends that you're trying to achieve are ever more evanescent because of the great amount of progress that has been made in this area. And appropriation is a kind of word or appropriate that always brings forth the question whether you've gone too far or not far enough, right? What is appropriate and inappropriate behavior? And so the balance can turn if, in fact, you think the evil to be prevented is minuscule compared to the heavy artillery that you're directing against.
Well, this does bring us logically to another question because, as you mentioned, Congress has repeatedly reauthorized and extended the Voting Rights Act. And as a result, several pundits, such as Linda Greenhouse of the New York Times, have criticized the prospect of the Supreme Court overturning this aspect of the law as a potential exercise in judicial activism. What do you make of that claim?
Well, the first of all is the question is, what do you make of any claim with respect to judicial activism? I think, by and large, the term has no valuable use in trying to figure out which way you ought to do it. So it just takes two other cases that are coming up. One is DOMA, you know, the Defense of Marriage Act, and the other is Prop H, defining a marriage between one man and one woman and excluding gay couples. And what you do is you have the same people who are screaming that you have to extend the VRA, the Voting Rights Act, now claiming that there's a moral duty that we strike down both of these statutes, and the very Democrats who voted for it back in the mid-90s are now clamoring, in effect, to overturn it. Well, is that a form of judicial activism? I think the real answer is, if the decision is legitimate based on correct principles of interpretation, it's a discharge of constitutional duty. If you strike something down which ought to be kept up, it's a derogation of duty, and the converse goes. If you strike something down that should be kept, that's bad. If you keep something that should be sucked down, that's bad as well. So we don't want to play the game. So you got to get back to the merits of the case. And on this particular circumstance, I just cannot understand how it should be regarded as appropriate to take these extremely draconian regimes and to apply them where there's not even a whisper of any past behavior. So, for example, in this Northwest Austin case that came up a couple of years before the Supreme Court, the issue was how you appoint a staggered board of individuals to a public utility board which was created in 1987. And, you know, now you have to go through all of this expense. And what you're really doing is you're not trying to figure out whether people are excluded from or allowed into the polls. You're really doing something very else. You're trying to say that, you know, we changed the nature of this board so that it's staggered instead of being chosen uniformly. Will that have an impact on the success of minority voters in being able to include the outcome of an election? And it's so evanescent and so remote that most of the secondary effects that they claim to have identified to justify the reenactment are in fact perfectly neutral practices of no particular valence. And the only thing that we do have which is deliberately race conscious today is the creation of the so-called majority-minority districts, where you essentially create districts with 72 sides that go down rivers and so forth in order to try to cobble together a majority of minority voters in a given area. So what the statute seems to do through its remedial stuff is to create race-conscious divisions of the sort that the original statute was not intended to do. Remember, the original version of the Act was not a Minority Protection Act as so forth. It was, in effect, having to do with the position of any citizen, right? Not just citizens of a certain kind of a situation. And what happens is the original view held by Hubert Humphrey is, look, at the present time, all the abuse is going in one direction. So it's going to be applied in one direction, not because we have a black-only eligibility requirement, but because that's the way the world works. But now when you start getting explicit discriminations by the government in the opposite direction, you would assume that intentional discrimination would be applied there. But what's happened is there's no neutrality with respect to this statute. So it's like the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It turns out to be a one-sided, not a two-sided statute. The general language which is covering these particular cases, that is, the right of any citizen of the United States, now is meant to read only to some citizens. And it seems to me that this is a serious form of generalized misconduct.
Final question. As critical as you are of those developments, in your piece for Defining Ideas, you are also critical of Justice Scalia's comment, which got a lot of press in oral arguments on this case, that the Voting Rights Act getting renewed and extended over and over again by Congress represented what he called the perpetuation of racial entitlement. In your judgment, is that an error of analysis or tone or both on his behalf?
Well, I think it's an error in both. First of all, essentially what happens is it makes it appear as though all the people who are, in fact, suspicious of what the VRA is now trying to do have themselves a real kind of animus and are trying to sort of even the score with respect to civil rights stuff. And that's not the view that I have at all. I mean, my view about it is it's just wrong, and it's wrong for all citizens. Now, why is it wrong for all citizens? Because you have to understand that when you start to increase the influence, say, of a majority-minority district, you're also increasing the influences, arguably, of some of the white citizens in that district. And when you decide to take other districts and to make them more Republican than they would otherwise be, now what you're doing is you're creating a racial entitlement for white Republicans, or one could so argue. One of the reasons why this thing is so difficult to work through on these so-called secondary effects arguments is that every time you change a district one way or another, you influence not only the composition of that particular district, but the composition of all districts. And sometimes you guess people's sentiments wrong. In some of these cases, there may be divisions amongst black and white voters of one kind or another. So what I do is I treat this as a kind of a bad form of civic government, and that we would be far better off and far more candid if we saved ourselves the expense and the rigidity of all of these things, because it would work for the benefit of everybody. Go back to Northwest Austin. How does it help members of minority groups to be taxed to run this ridiculous proposal when, in fact, on these particular issues, they have no difference, I would guess, as a group from those of any other racial group that you could possibly find? So this is just a case of massive overpowering of the government, by the government, of the way in which local governments work. And I think the correct thing to understand is that's really going on here is excessive federal powers relative to the states in an area which does nobody any good. So far from creating a perpetual entitlement for minority members, what it does is it creates a corrupted and a rather biased political process with heavy injections of prosecutorial discretion on whether we sign off or not sign off to the federal government. It's very much like the piece I talked about recently in Defining Ideas, where the mandate comes down that you have to hire ex-cons, and you only have to hire them if they're minority members. You don't have to hire them if they're not. It's the two-sided version of the civil rights laws, creates all sorts of unintended confusions. And indeed, at the ex-con case, it may well be that the white individuals who are freed from all of this kind of protection will find it better to get jobs than those on the other side. So there's a very credible body of literature that says Mr. Holder may think he's doing benefits to minority members, but in fact, the consequences of his actions go in the opposite direction. And with all the stuff on these secondary effects, no serious analysis can guarantee you that you even know the direction of a particular effect when you have some kind of change in the size of a community or in the way in which they organize the voting procedures or change the offices or move an election booth or something of the sort. So I think this is just massive overkill, which everybody in this country should be opposed to, including Linda Greenhouse.
Richard Epstein, thank you as always. A reminder to our listeners, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by going to hoover.org and clicking on Defining Ideas. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.